Well, thank you, everyone, for joining the teleclass, Biofilms and Their Role in Human Health. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, I'd like to say that it is indeed an honor to have all of you along with me today. Almost 4 years ago, a man named Dr. Bill Costerton accepted my invitation to come to Canada to give a lecture on this thing that he called biofilm. And what a lecture it was. That was the first time that I'd heard of biofilms, but it certainly hasn't been the last. Everyone seems to be talking about the health and environmental implications of biofilms these days, and in infection control, biofilm is big news. Dr. Costerton heads up the Center for Biofilm Engineering at the University of Montana, and there was another really bright and articulate fellow there whom I have been after for quite some time to give a teleclass, and he finally agreed. Dr. Ryan Jordan has since moved on from the University of Montana, but he hasn't moved very far geographically or academically. I see on his PowerPoint slides that he has a little bit about himself and his company there, so I'll let him speak to that. Let me just say quickly that Weber Training doesn't endorse any particular product or company, and due diligence is always advised. To give the teleclass, Biofilms and Their Role in Human Health, I am delighted to present Dr. Ryan Jordan. Ryan.
Thank you very much, and I'm thrilled to be here today. It's always a pleasure having the opportunity to talk about biofilms, especially in the context of human health, which is where a great deal of attention is being paid. More and more infectious diseases are being attributed to biofilm mechanisms, and we're going to talk about some of those today. I was a senior research engineer at the Center for Biofilm Engineering. Bill Costerton worked with Bill very closely on a variety of projects. And I left there in 2003 to found a company called Sitergy, which focuses on e-learning, scientific e-learning for corporate training purposes. And part of our core course program is certainly biofilms. I was the co-founder and chief operating officer of the Biofilm Institute from 1999 to 2003. And when I was there, our goal and our mission was to deliver biofilm education to both corporate and educational audiences. And one of our main publications out of the Biofilm Institute, which still runs under the helm of Ms. Diane Williams, is Biofilms Online, which is one of the Internet's largest databases of biofilm research and other information. Moving on, let's go ahead and forward to the outline of this presentation. There are six bullet points on the outline slide. We're going to cover the first four. I wish I could cover the last two, but an hour just doesn't give me enough time. And these two, anti-biofilm medical devices and intracellular chemical signaling, are both addressed in a number of our courses. So we're going to look at the fundamentals of biofilms, take a look at where biofilms are important in the context of human health, take a look at some therapeutic strategies, and then focus on biofilms and antimicrobial resistance, which is one of the hottest topics in the area of biofilm research today. The next slide asks the question, what is a biofilm? And this is open to a great deal of debate, both philosophically and scientifically. And I just try to keep it as simple as possible so we can all achieve some common ground in our definitions. Biofilm is a community of microorganisms that are attached to a surface. In the context of human health, that surface may be a living tissue, it may be a medical device, it may be biofilm that has contaminated a surgical instrument. We contrast biofilm cells with planktonic cells, which are simply individual cells of bacteria or fungi that are suspended in a fluid medium. So the main difference between biofilm bacteria and planktonic bacteria are that biofilms are indeed attached to a surface, and this has profound implications on how they react to the environment. What is all in a biofilm? Well, of course, there are living microorganisms, and this can include bacteria and yeast, which are the most common organisms in the human health context. In the environment, they also house algae, if you have biofilms exposed to sunlight, as well as protozoa. It has been known that Giardia, Cryptosporidia, they can hang out in a bacterial biofilm and become somewhat persistent in the environment. This is one of their mechanisms of survival. Biofilm can include dissolved and solid organic byproducts. These are byproducts of cell metabolism and cell death. And they include polysaccharides, lipids, proteins, and a variety of other organic compounds, as you might guess. And they can include solid inorganic products, such as minerals, crystals, soil particles, things like that. And, of course, dissolved inorganics. So the normal chemicals that are found in water or other fluids, metal salts, and other byproducts of cellular metabolism. So the next slide, what are key features of biofilm? They are multicellular organisms. And, you know, a biofilm is not classified as an organism, but it certainly behaves as a community. And they have some pretty remarkable properties that can be attributed to higher organisms. They are typically multi-species. Rare is the biofilm that consists of only one species. Those are typically only found in the laboratory. Biofilms are glued together by a matrix of extracellular polysaccharides. We abbreviate this with EPS. And they have a three-dimensional structure to them. They are not planar structures that exist at the surface. They grow in the Z dimension out from the surface and can form some remarkable structures. And in the next slide, we see a pictogram of one of these structures. And this is one of the classic depictions of a biofilm showing mushroom towers, columns of bacteria that are growing out from the surface, as well as streamers that can form in flowing medium. These streamers you can see as the kind of the long, wispy lines emanating from the top of the mushroom there. Another unique feature about biofilms is that they can harbor flow through them. This flow can carry nutrients, antibiotics, or other products that are meant to feed the biofilm or and otherwise control it. And the flow of nutrients flows through interstices in the biofilm that can include pores and channels. Now, a more subtle feature of this biofilm that's not immediately apparent, but if you look closely at the surface, you see a very thin layer of cells attached to that surface. If you try to knock out a biofilm with antibacterials, often you can disrupt the structure of the biofilm, but this surface of very persistent bacteria often remains, and they tend to seed the growth of future biofilms. And this is one reason why biofilms are so difficult to eradicate in industrial and medical contexts. Going to the next slide, which is titled Bacterial Biofilm Encased in EPS Matrix, we can zoom in and take a look at the structure of individual bacteria in the biofilm. This is with scanning electron microscopy. And we can see that they're encapsulated in this sticky, gluey exopolysaccharide matrix, and that's what you see attaching the cells to each other in this net-like structure. And this is actually how it looks. This is an environmental scanning electron microscope image, so these are developed in a fluid medium, and the biofilms are not dried out. So what you are looking at in this picture is reasonably similar to an actual live biofilm, and you can see the pores and channels through which nutrients can flow. The cells are not stacked right on top of each other. And this is actually a fairly dense biofilm. Often we see images like this where cells, only a few cells, are encapsulated in a much slimier matrix. Next slide asks, how does biofilm form? And we separate this into three key processes. One is attachment, two is colonization, and three is growth. In order to seed a surface, you need to have a cell absorb or adhere to that surface. And then it colonizes, and it colonizes by establishing a microbial community at the site of attachment. And it does so by via the attachment of other cells and via growth of that first layer on the surface. And then when we look at growth of the biofilm, that's when we start moving in three dimensions and we're looking at that community maturing into a much more complex structure. These three processes are depicted on the next slide, attachment, colonization, and growth. The slide after that asks, where are biofilms found? Well, pretty much everywhere you look for them, we've been able to find them. The natural environment certainly has biofilms, stream bed, algae-coated rocks, that's kind of the classic example. Even in the most pristine waterways we've been able to visit, where we know that few, if any, humans have ever been there, far above the tree line in the alpine zones, where animal life is almost void, we've been able to find biofilms on the rocks. So even when there is a lack of an invertebrate or insect population in a high mountain creek, it can be loaded with bacteria forming nice slimy biofilms. Industrial systems, these biofilms have been recognized for many, many years, and we're only now, in the past decade or so, really starting to get a handle on controlling these biofilms. Anytime you have an industrial water process where you are distributing or moving processed water through pipes or heat exchangers or the like, you're going to have problems with biofouling. And this biofouling can cause damage to the pipes, especially if they're metal. Biofilms are notorious for their ability to corrode metal. They can cause process inefficiencies by increasing friction in the pipe and increasing the amount of energy required to move processed water through the pipe. And they can cause inefficiencies, for example, on a heat exchanger, where heat transfer is impaired because of biofilm sitting on the exchanger unit. We find biofilms in the human body just about everywhere. The classic examples are the lining of the stomach, where most of the time biofilms are considered beneficial. They are found on the skin, naturally occurring skin flora. But at the same time, these beneficial biofilms that do exist on the skin can infect, for example, a catheter going in through the skin surface, and once it gets into the bloodstream can cause problems. And this is one mode of infection. We'll probably talk about that. And, of course, the mouth. Dental biofilms have been studied for many years, and biofilms are the responsible party in dental caries or cavities. They also play a very important role in things like halitosis and gingivitis. So what is the criteria for biofilm growth? It's basically any confluence of a water-based fluid, a surface, and a microorganism that is capable of producing a biofilm. And in general, most microorganisms play some role in biofilm formation, especially bacteria. The next slide asks, what makes biofilm ubiquitous? Microorganisms are ubiquitous. So there's your simplest answer right there. Since microorganisms prefer to grow in the biofilm mode of growth, it follows then that biofilms are ubiquitous because microorganisms are ubiquitous. Biofilms are the preferred mode of growth for two main reasons. One, you get some efficiencies from growing in a community rather than trying to survive as a sole organism. And it's a survival mechanism from various stresses, including heat and cold, starvation, desiccation, resistance to toxic substances, and as we'll close this presentation with resistance to antibiotics. So moving on to the general topic of biofilms in human health, they occur in a variety of contexts that are listed on this slide here. Waterborne illnesses, airborne, foodborne, household biofilms. And then the three that we're really going to talk about today, medical devices and implants, infectious diseases, and dental health. The next slide reads medical devices and implants, and this list can go on and on and on. There are new discoveries made seemingly every month where biofilms are implicated in the contamination of a new type of device or implant. But the most common and the ones that we've been studying for a few years now include the context of catheterization, prostheses, reconstruction of skin, organ transplant and repair, wound healing. We've done quite a lot of research, especially in the areas of catheterization, prosthesis failure, and wound healing. The next slide, which shows the tip of a catheter, this is a Foley or urinary catheter. This tip is encrusted with a biofilm that is quite hard, and it's encrusted with a mineral crust. And you can actually feel this when you feel the end of that catheter tip, and it's basically the salts that are deposited there by the biofilm. And this salt matrix encapsulates cells that become infective and can cause incredibly persistent bladder infections or urinary tract infections in general. Catheters and other invasive devices are the number one exogenous case of hospital-acquired or nosocomial infection. The amount of money spent on treating catheter-borne infections is remarkable, and the NIH has given a lot of attention to this in the last 4 years or so, has devoted a lot of money into incubating the development of new technologies to try to limit catheter-borne infections. And we're starting to see these technologies hit the market in the form of catheters that do have anti-biofilm surfaces. The next slide shows a scanning electron micrograph of biofilm on an intravenous catheter. And this is only 24 hours after the catheter is inserted. And we can see a red blood cell, that pretty smooth little dish shape that's sitting on the surface. But we can also see quite a lot of cocci-shaped cells encapsulated in EPS on the surface. And this, you know, 24 hours is not a lot of time for a biofilm to colonize a surface, but as you can see, these bacteria have already got a stronghold. It's very difficult to engineer in a surface that's completely resistant to bacteria attachment. Bacteria will attach to anything. And this was considered to be kind of the holy grail of the anti-biofilm surface 10 years ago. However, we've come to learn that biofilms will pretty much stick to anything, and the real focus has been on technologies that prevent the cells from growing on the surface once they hit. Obviously, this surface in this picture is not an antibacterial surface. The next slide outlines some examples of prosthetic infections that can occur. Primarily, artificial limbs, prosthetic eyes, dentures are three of the more common ones. And prosthetic implants such as, when you do a full knee replacement and you put a titanium knee or a titanium screw into a joint, these are quite prone to biofilm formation. Now, they don't cause the failure of that joint, but they provide a source of infection which can cause pain and inflammation in that joint area. The next slide, which outlines a few examples of superficial reconstruction, skin and subcutaneous infections, obviously contaminated as a result of the biofilm that exists on the skin surface. Skin is pretty hard to work with and remain anti-infective at times. The next slide outlines organ transplant and repair. Kidneys, heart, and contamination during organ transfer. I've outlined the kidneys and the heart because they are two of the more common transplant contexts where biofilms are implicated in long-term infection. The ability to successfully manage an organ transplant depends in large part on the ability to maintain an infection-free patient until the transplant has had the chance to become biocompatible with the body. This is very difficult. With kidneys, I've placed an asterisk by the word dialysis because often biofilms can contaminate dialysis equipment outside the body and cause the infection of the patient as the fluid is recirculated back in. So here's a case where you have a biofilm that exists on equipment that the patient is not the source of the contamination, and then the fluid comes back in and infects the patient. And obviously this is somewhat disconcerting. And a lot of companies have spent a lot of money developing kidney dialysis equipment that has some biofilm control built in. The next slide outlines wound healing. And there's a lot of, are we on wound healing? I'm on the wrong slide here. Hold on. Okay, wound healing. Contamination from the outside environment is the primary mode of infection. Again, you're looking at cells that are possibly airborne if you're in the context of a hospital environment, or you have a wound that's exposed to dirty conditions. For example, if you're treating a person with first aid in the backcountry or in a first responder context. You can have proliferation of the infection inside the wound and proliferation of the infection in the wound dressing. So there's two approaches to tackling biofilm control in wounds, and one is to make a wound dressing that has anti-biofilm properties, and the other is to make sure you're dosing that wound, the wound itself, with antibiotic therapy to control any cells that are growing inside the wound. The next slide outlines infectious diseases, the role of biofilms in originating, mediating, and proliferating infectious diseases is becoming more important with an increasing number and variety of infections. Most infections 10 years ago, 15 years ago, were never mentioned in the same context as biofilm. The number of infections that are mentioned in the context of biofilm today would fill up 10 slides with very small print. It's remarkable how many infectious diseases can be attributed to biofilm activity. Why is that? Well, the next slide outlines one reason. Biofilms are indigenous to the body. Healthy microflora exists in the ear, nose, mouth, throat, GI tract, skin, vagina, bowels, colon, on and on and on. The problem with these cells is that when you take them out of their natural environment, for example, if you take a skin cell that occurs naturally on the skin surface, and quite happily and without incident to the human host, and then you put that biofilm cluster in the lung or the bloodstream, you can have some problem. So it's the common mode of infection is when you transfer or transport microflora that is growing healthy in one spot and disrupts the body function in another spot. Next slide lists some of the most common biofilm-mediated infectious diseases, ophthalmic infections, ear, nose, and throat infections, heart and lung infections, GI tract. Biofilms interfere with urinary and sexual functions because they are known to cause severe infections in the urinary tract, prostate, and, of course, skin infections, which we've touched on. Let's take a look at a few of these. Here's an example, that next slide, which shows an infectious disease of the eye, shows an eye that is coated with a biofilm, and this is conjunctivitis, a very severe case of conjunctivitis. This particular photo is a corneal ulcer, but it's bacterially mediated, and you probably can't see the detail of the infection on your printout, but typically there are some discolored areas. One is near the bottom of the eye, and the other is right in the middle. And those discolored areas are actually a buildup of exopolysaccharide, and what you're looking at is a very slimy biofilm in that eye that has infected a corneal ulcer. The next slide shows inflamed tonsils, which are a common biofilm infection of the ear, nose, and throat, and there are other biofilm-mediated infections in this area as well. The next slide illustrates one of the most common and costly biofilm infections, and that is otitis media, which is the infection of the ear, which is most common in young children. On the left, you see a normal eardrum with lots of topography, and on the right, you see an eardrum that is, at least in my color picture here, is very red. It's inflamed, so much of the topography is missing, and there is an acute otitis media ear infection. One of the most common treatments for otitis media is intubation of the ear to drain this inflammation. That inflammation is a direct result of biofilm activity within the eardrum. The next slide illustrates an example of some heart and lung infections that are compounded, if not attributed, by biofilms, including tuberculosis, whooping cough, myocarditis, and endocarditis. Next slide shows a patient x-ray of pneumonia. Pneumonia is an infection that is mediated by copious production of exopolysaccharide that causes aggravation of the lung tissue and interferes with oxygen exchange because of the biofilm that is there. The next slide shows a more severe but equally important infection, that is cystic fibrosis. This patient is infected with a biofilm that is chronic, unfortunately. The CF biofilms eventually take over the lung to the point where they kill the patient. The CF lung is one of the, probably the best studied lung infection in the context of biofilms. We've learned as much from how bacteria behave in a biofilm from studies on CF lungs as in any other context. We've known about the role of biofilms in these for a long time and are now at the point, now that we kind of understand how the CF infection occurs, we're now at the point where we can begin to target biofilm behavior and come up with treatments for managing CF patients. And the result of that has been that we are very successfully extending the lives of CF patients who have these severe biofilm lung infections. The next slide, which I don't think you have it in color, but it's probably a good thing. This is endocarditis. A severe bacterial infection of heart tissue. And when biofilms form infections on heart tissue, they have these unique structures to them, and they're very pretty, and they look kind of like cauliflower. And you can kind of see two of those structures in the lung tissue in the middle of this slide here. Next slide, again, GI tract infections, urinary tract infections, skin infections. We're not going to go into detail too much on those here because of time, but do recognize that these are also very common biofilm-mediated infections. Dental health, on the next slide, is an area where a lot of time and attention is spent on understanding biofilm ecology. And the reason I bring up ecology is because here's an example where if you took an individual species and grew biofilms on a tooth, you're probably not going to get cavity formation. But because there are two or three key species in the mouth that have symbiotic relationships with each other, it is only when they grow together in what is really a kind of a complex ecological relationship, do they form things like caries and periodontal disease. and halitosis. It's a pretty fascinating ecological study, and quite a lot has been done on it. Another area of dental health that's being looked at closely is the contamination of dental unit water lines by source water. Biofilms can grow on the interior of dental unit water lines, which are fairly narrow in diameter. The water is reasonably warm for reasons of patient comfort, and it's a good environment for biofilms to grow. There has been changes in management practices as a result of understanding the role of biofilms in dental unit water lines. Some dentists are going to daily fresh purified water. Many are using daily purge and disinfection of their water lines. And the goal here is to minimize the risk of infecting patients. Now, most of us are not going to be infected by biofilms in dental unit water lines, but it's a very important issue for patients that are immunocompromised. The next slide discusses dental caries in more detail. And in general, dental caries can be described as enamel-bound biofilm, and we call this plaque, which metabolizes carbohydrates that are sourced from your food and in general from your saliva. And the result of this metabolism is a series of acids that end up dissolving the tooth enamel and causing a cavity. How we control dental caries is through plaque removal, and it's extremely difficult to passively remove plaque. That's why it's so important to go to the dentist frequently and have it manually scraped off your teeth. Because regardless of how well we brush or floss, there's going to be some degree of calcification of these biofilms on the enamel surface. And when this calcification occurs, the bacteria that are encapsulated in that calcified matrix become very resistant to even the best mouth rinses and antibiotic rinses on the market. And they can cause cavities slowly over the long term. Physical removal of the biofilm via flossing and brushing on a daily basis does get rid of the majority of the cells that do form within that period since your last teeth cleaning. How do you prevent the formation of biofilm on the teeth? Well, we do this through antimicrobial rinses, fluoride. For patients that have enamel problems, we use dental sealants if they have naturally thin enamel. There's a lot of genetic reasons why some people are prone to mouth problems and some people aren't. So genetics certainly plays a role, but the best thing you can do is pay special attention to how you care for your teeth. Periodontal disease is also attributed to biofilms, and this is the infection of tissues that surround and support the teeth. This is the primary cause of tooth loss in older adults, and the stages include gingivitis, which is early and reversible, and periodontitis, which is late, often irreversible, and often requiring surgery. The role of biofilm is that you get colony infestation into the gum tissue. And these biofilm colonies actually grow underneath the gum line and are not usually accessible by casual toothbrushing and flossing. Their remote location, in addition, makes it extremely resistant to antimicrobial therapies such as rinses, and it emphasizes the need for debridement as the primary treatment. And debridement is the process of manually removing that biofilm in a dentist office. There are some over-the-counter debridement tools coming onto the market as well. How do you prevent periodontal disease? Well, you develop rinse treatments that can prevent biofilm colonization of gum tissues. And we're starting to see some effectiveness by some of the rinses on the market because they remain bound. Some of the components of the rinses, especially the essential oils rinses, they remain bound to the tooth surface and can provide some long-term biofilm resistance as you sleep. And these are some of the newer developments that are coming out in the area of biofilm research in dental contexts. Halitosis, the primary cause, is the metabolic activity of oral bacteria feeding on post-nasal drip, and these occur in the back of the tongue. These are protein metabolizers in contrast to sugar metabolizers. When sugar-metabolizing bacteria, these are the ones that cause dental caries, metabolize the carbohydrates in your mouth. The byproduct is acids, and these acids are typically fairly benign in terms of odor. Protein metabolism, however, causes some extremely foul-smelling substances, and we find that the ecology of the bacteria that exist on the back of the tongue, as well as the food they're eating, is quite different than the food and the ecology of the biofilms that exist around the gum line or at the tooth. Some of the compounds that are produced, well, you can get an idea of the chemicals that are there and where you might find those chemicals in common life. And I'm not saying that, you know, you find feces and corpses and decaying meat in common life, but that provides you with some context about where these chemicals are found and what kinds of odors they produce. Dental unit water lines, the next slide. The problem scope is that biofilm growth in dental unit water lines poses potential risk of pathogen exposure primarily to immunocompromised patients. The next slide asks, why are dental unit water lines so susceptible to biofilm formation? We talked about this already a little bit, but you're looking at a very low volume, low shear flow, very small tube diameter, which increases the surface area to volume ratio of the reactor, so to speak, in which the biofilm is growing. You have very long tubing lengths, room temperature or warmer water for patient comfort, and a lot of times plastic tubing. And plastic tubing is cheaper. It's far easier to maintain and replace, but it does typically foster growth of biofilms a little more than metal tubing. So some dental unit waterline biofilm control strategies, moving to the next slide, is moving to cleaner source water. We're seeing more and more dental offices going to independent reservoir systems rather than using public tap water. Point of use microorganism filtration, there's a lot of sophistication in this area. One of the more common techniques is to put a reverse osmosis filter before that water ever enters the water line. And what you're doing here is minimizing the number of cells that enter that water line. Whether you can actually sterilize with reverse osmosis is debatable because the technology is difficult to monitor in terms of when that membrane fails and lets bacteria through. But in general, reverse osmosis tends to be pretty effective. Point of use disinfection, so you may run the water from the reservoir through an UV irradiator and disinfect any cells that do manage to make it through the primary filter. And of course, regular dental unit waterline maintenance, such as chemical and physical cleaning, and the benefit of using plastic tubing gives you the opportunity to replace the water lines at a far less cost than if you were using metal. Okay, let's change gears and move into therapeutic strategies for dealing with biofilms. And we're going to talk about three primary strategies. One is to disrupt biofilm cell function. One is to disrupt biofilm structure. And one is try to inhibit growth. Next slide, which reads disruption of biofilm cell function. This is the traditional method. This is the method on which antibiotic-based infection control is based. The objective here is to kill individual cells by targeting specific cell function. So maybe that cell function is DNA replication, maybe it's membrane integrity, but the bottom line is we want to prevent that cell from living and or growing. The problem with this is that biofilms are notorious for their ability to protect individual cells in their community. They do this through a variety of mechanisms, which we'll get into in the last section of this talk, but it's largely related to the fact that they are encapsulated in this EPS matrix and that biofilm cells have a different physiological makeup than planktonic cells. The next slide, which says disruption of biofilm structure, this is the traditional method in cleaning industrial manufacturing equipment. So we're using soaps, detergents, surfactants, scrapers, what have you, to eliminate biofilm from the surface. The problem with this, in terms of human health, is that it has some in vivo challenges, because if you use something akin to a soap or a detergent or a surfactant, you can elicit a negative host response, and we call these things side effects. And it's challenging to, for example, if there is a biofilm infection in a blood vessel, it's challenging to introduce a therapeutic chemical in there that is capable of disrupting the biofilm structure without causing some kind of host response. There is some research working on this. I think we're going to see in the next probably 10 years, we're going to start seeing drugs hit the market that do just this. But we are still a little ways out in this area. So the next slide, which also reads disruption of biofilm structure, the objectives here are to transform a biofilm cell to a planktonic cell. We do this by disrupting the EPS matrix that binds cells together, which thus promotes cell detachment from the surface. Now, once those cells are no longer in a biofilm mode of growth, you can nail them with an antibiotic and they become much more susceptible to killing. So this is the big motivation here. There's a big difference between the resistance of a biofilm cell to an antibiotic and the resistance of a planktonic cell to an antibiotic. Obviously, this is a relatively new concept in human health, and there's much room for R&D here, and there are companies that have sprouted up to do just this exact function. The next slide reads inhibition of biofilm growth. And here we want to do one of two things. We want to either create an anti-biofilm surface, in other words, create a surface on which cells either can't attach, or if they do attach, do not form a biofilm. Or we engineer an anti-biofilm forming cell. And now with cells that exist naturally, you can't engineer a cell, but there are some technologies being developed that allow you to introduce a relatively benign chemical into the system that reacts with that cell and prevents it from forming a biofilm. We call these chemicals signaling chemicals. The whole process is receiving a lot of attention today as an anti-biofilm strategy. And we won't be discussing that today, but that is a topic in one of our other courses, which I'll highlight at the end. Another way to inhibit antimicrobial biofilm growth is through antimicrobial coatings on devices and implants. This is the primary mechanism that is being addressed today in the device community. The real question is, are there in vivo strategies for tissue infection prevention? This is where the challenges of today really lie. The answer is probably. They're being developed, but in terms of having therapies that are available right now, we're just not there yet. Finally, let's move into the last section of this presentation, and I'll devote some time to this. It's on antimicrobial resistance. We'll talk about nosocomial or hospital-acquired infections, antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and the mechanisms by which biofilm bacteria become resistant to antibiotics. Some examples of nosocomial infections: hospitals are notorious breeding grounds for bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics. Hospital air and water systems are known sources of bacteria that end up causing nosocomial infections. Legionnaire's disease has been found in many, many, many hospital warm water faucets and shower heads, and quite a few hospital workers actually carry the antibodies for Legionnaire's disease. They become immune to it. Hospital staff sanitation practices are certainly worth considering. We're seeing more and more medical devices and instruments become reusable, and now that the FDA is applying guidelines to reusable devices, we've seen nosocomial infections resulting from them drop a bit, but it's created a new market, and that is cleaning and restoration procedures for reusable devices and instruments. And of course, infections that occur during invasive procedures such as surgery. There is a group of bacteria, this is shown on the next slide, there's a group of bacteria that we like to call the nosocomial troika. And these are the three most common families of organisms known to produce very healthy, very resistant biofilms that cause hospital-acquired infections. Staph, Pseudomonas, and E. coli. It's 90% of hospital-acquired infections can be attributed to these three organisms. What is unique, and the reason I bring these three bugs up, is that they all form incredibly vigorous biofilms. The most common, next slide, most common nosocomial infections include pneumonia, and we've actually classified this as nosocomial pneumonia, and often treatment strategies for nosocomial pneumonia are different than environmentally acquired pneumonia. Surgical wound infections remain a real hotbed and has fostered an entire industry built around creating anti-infective wound products. And the third that's very common is vascular access-related bacteremia. So if you introduce a central venous catheter to a patient, that catheter carries some staph epi off the skin into the patient's bloodstream and causes an infection. Quite common. Next slide, what is the main problem with nosocomial bacteria? We're dealing with bugs that have often acquired antibiotic resistance because they have grown out of the resistant populations that exist in the hospital. Currently, the organism of greatest concern is vancomycin-resistant staph aureus, or VRSA. This bug forms vigorous biofilms. It is resistant to the hospital's holy grail of antibiotics, vancomycin. It's one of the most effective antibiotics available for tackling staph infections, and the fact that we have a bug that is resistant to it makes control of those infections much more problematic. The next slide reads antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Hospitals, and especially ICUs, are a breeding ground for these bacteria. The risk of leaving a hospital with an ARB infection is real, and I've given you a couple links that discuss antibiotic resistance, especially as related to nosocomial bacteria from the CDC there at the bottom of that slide. Next slide reads biofilms and nosocomial infections. Biofilms are playing an increasingly important role in the spread of these infections because we are starting to renovate aging hospitals. This increases the risk of airborne fungal and bacterial pathogens that are present as biofilm in the infrastructure of the building, molds and Legionella being the primary two. The second main reason why these infections are important is because we are using increasingly aggressive medical and surgical interventions, which places patients at higher risk. We are doing more transplants. We're using more devices. We are implanting more devices into folks. And just the fact that you're using invasive procedures is going to increase the risk for the population. Some of the mechanisms of antimicrobial resistance by biofilms, and we'll talk about four of them. The first is slow penetration, stress response, an altered microenvironment, and persisters. Let's move on to the next pictograph and take a look at slow penetration. Here you have a biofilm that is bacteria encapsulated in this EPS matrix, and there is a lighter contrast color on the outside edge of the biofilm that indicates the degree to which an antibiotic may penetrate the biofilm. So the fact that you have a three-dimensional gel-like structure here prevents penetration. It's simply a diffusion mechanism, where if cells were dispersed in a test tube in an aqueous medium, the antibiotic would have no problem reaching all those cells. But it certainly has a problem reaching cells in the lower layer of the biofilm. The next slide, which is titled Stress Response, some cells in a biofilm may be exposed to environmental stress, such as toxicity or lack of nutrients, and they elicit a stress response that makes them less prone to an antimicrobial. So here we're talking about, if you look at the next slide, we see some cells in the middle of the biofilm that may be, for some reason or another, maybe it's related to pore or void channels within the biofilm. Let's say they're nutrient poor. And these cells have kind of shut down their metabolism. Well, a lot of antimicrobials depend on metabolic function in order to work. So if that metabolic function is altered, these cells may have developed an inherent resistance to those antimicrobials as a result of the fact that they're just not as healthy as some of the other cells in the biofilm. The next slide, which reads altered microenvironment, here we're talking about localized micro-niches within a biofilm that may harbor a microenvironment that renders an antimicrobial ineffective. Two examples here, we have a change in solution chemistry caused by cell activity, heterogeneous cell activity within the biofilm. And that solution chemistry, let's say it's a pH change or the presence of a particular acid, may render that antibiotic or that chemical less effective in that region of the biofilm than in other regions of the biofilm. The other reason we might have an altered microenvironment is that we may have a colony of cells in one location of the biofilm that is exuding components such as exopolysaccharide or perhaps a particular protein or lipid that neutralizes or otherwise inhibits the effectiveness of that antimicrobial. The next slide shows this in a picture, and the base of the biofilm here we've kind of shaded in a different color and illustrated the fact that these cells may just be doing some different things to the solution chemistry locally, only in that region of the biofilm. And so when an antimicrobial enters that region, it may be less effective against those cells. The final mechanism on the next slide is persisters. These are the cells that just won't go away. And largely, there's a few mechanisms for what we call persistence. But largely, these are strains that are simply resistant to antibiotics. And these are cells within a population that may have formed a mutation that has caused some antimicrobial resistance. They may have developed a cell wall or cell membrane that is resistant to penetration, that is unlike the other aspects of the population. But for whatever reason, these are the guys that hang around even after you've aggressively treated the biofilm. In the next slide, we can see these persisters. There's not very many of them. Typically, what we call persisters comprise an incredibly small fraction of the biofilm, maybe 1/10,000th or more. But if you're wiping out all the biofilm but these, and then these guys grow back, guess who their sons and daughters are? The same persistent strain. And this is kind of the mechanism by which biofilms become very resistant over the long term, say in a chronic infection of a patient by a strain that develops antimicrobial resistance. And then the next slide kind of shows all these mechanisms together. On a printout, it probably doesn't tell a big story, but the slide is incredibly important because it illustrates, above all else, the complexity that we're dealing with here. We just don't have to deal with this complexity if you have a simple bloodstream infection and no biofilm source, or a urinary tract infection with no biofilm source. But once we have a source that can introduce planktonic cells over and over and over into the body, then we have a chronic problem. And that's why urinary tract infections and cystic fibrosis and tonsillitis and a lot of these things are indeed chronic infections. It has to do with the failure to kill or eradicate the biofilm. A lot of the information I pulled out of this talk today came from some of our other courses. We offer a variety of video-based CD courses that you can take on your computer. We have Paul Studley, who is a well-known researcher in the area of biofilms, kind of has our signature piece, which is called An Introduction to Biofilm Science and Engineering. And Bill Costerton has done a couple of biofilm courses for us. The one that's probably most interesting and contributed most to this talk was medical biofilm microbiology. And Phil Stewart has what I gave on antimicrobial resistance in an hour-long talk that's much more in-depth. And then the next slide illustrates some of the biofilm books that we publish, including a new one called Advances in Biofilm Science and Engineering, which is kind of a trade book looking at some various topics in foodborne biofilms and processing, health, drinking water, and things like that. And then the Biofilm Laboratory, which is kind of our de facto standard for laboratory methods if you're interested in doing any biofilm studies in your labs. Feel free to contact me if you have any follow-up questions. I'm more than happy to answer them. My phone number and email are there. I travel a bit, so you're not going to always get me by phone, but I will call you back. And there's our address below if you'd like to write or send anything as well. Thank you very much, and I will turn things back over to Paul.
Great. Well, thank you, Ryan, for a stunning and at times shocking presentation. Ryan, I'm pleased that we were ultimately finally able to get together to do this teleclass. I'm glad that we waited. It was certainly well worth the wait. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank all of you for joining us today. We'll talk again very, very soon. Goodbye.